loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. President Obama has officially ended the three-decades-old arms embargo against Vietnam on his trip to Hanoi. As tensions continue to mount in the South China Sea, is the real reason for the change to counter the growth of China. What does Vietnam want? The Iraqi army has announced the beginning of an offensive to retake the city of Fallujah from the so-called Islamic State. Fallujah was the first city to fall to Daesh in 2014. Is it possible to talk about the liberation of Fallujah by bombs and missiles 12 years after the United States military virtually leveled that city? The second officer charged in the death of Freddie Gray, Edward Nero, has been found not guilty of all four misdemeanor charges. Will justice ever be served in the death of Freddie Gray, a death that triggered last year's rebellion and uprising in Baltimore? But first, we turn to Obama's visit to Vietnam. We are joined by Dr. Alexander Vuving. He is a security analyst and professor at the Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Hawaii. Welcome, Alexander.
Hello.
The Obama administration has lifted the military embargo on Vietnam yesterday when President Obama had his press conference. What kind of weapons and military equipment is Vietnam looking to buy from the United States?
I think the lifting of the full U.S. embargo on weapons, rather about creating and building trust with Vietnam rather than weapons commerce. The Vietnamese are obviously looking for some U.S. weapons, but that is for the long term. I think in the short term, the Vietnamese will be studying what kinds of weapons they need from the United States. And they also have other sources of weapons to buy from. U.S. weapons are usually more expensive than some other weapons with the same quality and same functions. So I think the Vietnamese will not be very quick in jumping into the U.S. Weapons market. But I think the key meaning of the end of the U.S. embargo is to build trust with the Vietnamese military and the conservatives within the Vietnamese regime.
Well, there are sources in the U.S. media and some of the international media that claim that the greatest potential for U.S. military sales to Vietnam lies in surveillance systems and coastal defense, and that Vietnam might want surveillance systems that can track, say, the Chinese Navy. What kind of surveillance system do you think Vietnam might be considering?
I think Vietnam might be considering buying some patrol aircraft, early warning aircraft, some radar systems. So basically, weapons that would enhance the capability to monitor and patrol in the South China Sea. But I think in the world market, the Vietnamese also can look at sources from other countries as well, Israel, Russia. So I think it's, again, the Vietnamese will not jump very quickly into this U.S. market.
I mean, Vietnam has been diversifying its procurement of weapons in the last couple of years. And, of course, Russia is its largest supplier. But can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, Vietnam is the number one principle for them is to diversify the sources of their procurement. So in the last couple of years, Vietnam has reached out to non-traditional sources such as Israel, France, Sweden, Canada, and South Korea, and so to buy weapons. And now with the fully lifting of the U.S. Arms embargo, the Vietnamese will obviously will also look at the U.S. sources.
Of course, China, the People's Republic of China's official position is that island disputes, territorial disputes, maritime disputes of any type in the region should be handled on the basis of bilateral relations between the PRC, the People's Republic of China, and other governmental entities, other government parties, be they the Philippines or Vietnam. From your point of view, do you think that the United States is trying to woo Vietnam as part of a larger network or a bloc that would be an anti-China bloc in the region?
I don't see the U.S. policy as trying to create such a bloc. I think the U.S. is also prudent about relationships with China, and they don't want to create the feeling in China that everyone is ganging up against China. I think, and same in Vietnam. So I think both Vietnamese and the U.S. are very cautious about, provoking China. But their relationship, also has its own aspect, which does not, related to China, I think, the reconciliation between the U.S. and Vietnam has its own value rather than just a response to China, I think.
Right. Of course, China invaded Vietnam in 1979, and there's been a historical longer period in which there's been a conflict between China and Vietnam. There's also been a period in which they were allies, of course, during the U.S. war in Vietnam. Talk about the Vietnamese government's leadership. There is the general secretary of the Vietnamese Communist Party. There's the prime minister. There's the president, who largely a ceremonial position. He was the one who was meeting and having the press conference with President Obama. Vietnam, in terms of its leadership, it's not really an anti-Chinese leadership for the most part, is it?
Yes. I think the Vietnamese, two things I want to say about the Vietnamese leadership. One is that it's divided over the policies, the preferred policies toward the great powers, in the particularly China and the United States. At the same time, the principle of working within the Vietnamese leadership is to work through consensus. So you have different views represented by different factions, but they all try, to decide by consensus. So that's why you see very slow process of decision making in Vietnam, particularly in terms of foreign policy. But the general trend today is that the Vietnamese are very leery of China's ambition in the South China Sea, and there has been a consensus among different factions in Vietnam about the Chinese intentions. They are just they disagree about the preferred approach to how to respond to that. To the Chinese expansion in the South China Sea. And so there are people who are more supportive of strengthening ties with the United States and other other powers that are at odds with China, like Japan and India and the Philippines and so on. But there are also people in the Vietnamese leadership who are more suspicious of the Western influence in Vietnam, and also they want to they prefer a more softer line with China, and they hope that pursuing a reconciliatory policy with China, they can, diffuse tensions with China and South China. So you have different views within Vietnamese leadership about how to approach China and the South China Sea, but they work, on consensus. So that's the uniqueness of Vietnam.
In other words, it is a collective leadership.
Yes.
Yeah. I was looking at Investor Business Daily. I don't know if you consider it a credible force, but I'll read to you something that they lead one of their articles about this issue, the one that we're talking about. It says, Boeing, Lockheed Martin, and Raytheon could be big winners in Vietnam as the U.S. fully lifts its arms embargo against its one-time enemy. And then, of course, it talks about the country's been on Vietnam has been on an arms-buying spree amid tensions over China's expansion. I'm quoting them again. Vietnam is the world's number 8 arms importer. What you're saying, Professor, is that you don't believe that for Boeing, Lockheed, Raytheon, or the other military contractors, Vietnam is by necessity now going to be a big market.
No, I don't think so. Vietnam will not be a very big market for the U.S. Weapon producers. The Vietnamese are trying to diversify the sources of their procurement, and they also have their own needs, which I think will be fulfilled by some weapons from Russia and Israel, so not just the United States, but also, U.S. weapons are usually more expensive than weapons from Russia. So I think, but the Vietnamese are also keen on transfer of technology. So that is something that they really look for after the U.S. Lifted the arms embargo.
So let's talk about that, because just as with China's own development since the economic reforms in the late 1970s, technology transfer, that is the acquisition of the latest technologies in any industry, the arrangements being that the buyer, the procurer, buys certain technologies, but in turn gets access to technologies. Or technology transfers, That's with the development of Vietnam's own indigenous industry then.
Yes, Vietnam wanted to develop its own indigenous military technology and develop industry. But I think it cannot be compared with China because China can absorb the latest technology, the highest level of technology, but Vietnam is not able to absorb all kind of that. So the Vietnam wants transfer of technology, but at the same time, it's unable to absorb the highest level. So the kind of technology that Vietnam will, be able to see are much more, lower in the advancement scale.
That's because of the disparity in size between China and Vietnam, or the level of its economic and social development?
Both.
Vietnam bought, through Vietjet, I believe, 100 Boeing 737s for its fleet recently. These are, of course, civilian airliners. So there's another element of purchase of high technology or technology transfer or just the introduction of latest technologies into Vietnam that are not military. How big a part of the program for Vietnam is that?
Yeah, I think the Vietjet deal is related to the growing market that Vietjet, which is the private airliner in Vietnam, the biggest private airliner in Vietnam, they are expanding their market. So that's also another aspect that Boeing can also look for.
Right. And Professor Vuvin, I want to ask you about the situation in the South China Seas or the East Sea. I mean, how is it developing from your point of view? Are we on a collision course, or is it possible? Do you think it's possible that China and Vietnam, China and Philippines, China and the other countries in the region can come to some sort of agreement, some way to mediate or mitigate the dispute so that real military clashes and conflicts become avoidable?
I think right now armed clashes already avoidable. Both the Chinese and the Southeast Asian countries try hard to avoid a war. What the Chinese are doing is to pursue the sort of gray zone expansion. So, at the same time as they are expanding and building island, deploying their assets to the sea, but they are cautious not to provoke the other opponents. And Vietnam and the Philippines are also have no stomach to initiate a war with China. So I think likelihood of war in the South China is fairly low. But at the same time, China still are at odds with Vietnam and the Philippines, and I don't think that tensions will be lower in the near future. I think it's going to be growing, but it has to grow up until it can grow down. It can go down.
Yeah, President Obama put the lifting of the arms embargo on Vietnam as not as an anti-China move. He said that sort of explicitly, but as part of what he would describe as the normal process of the normalization of relations between the U.S. and Vietnam 41 years after Vietnam was reunited under a communist-led government. Is it likely, though, that the Vietnamese government, under the circumstances of normalization, would ever grant the U.S. Navy increased access, say, to the port of Cam Ranh Bay? What's the importance of the port, and that ironically was a major supply point for the U.S. during the war in Vietnam?
Yeah, I think the Obama administration's decision to fully lift the arms embargo against Vietnam is an act of soft power. It's an act of kindness, and it clearly can create more trust with the Vietnamese regime. And in return, I think the Vietnamese will open the port in Cam Ranh Bay to U.S. military assets. So I think it's very likely that the U.S. Will be granted access to Cam Ranh Bay, not on a permanent basis, but at least at first, something similar to what the Vietnamese has granted to the Japanese military last year and early this year. In terms of the strategic importance of Cam Ranh Bay, it's the best naval port in the South China Sea. And so I think if the U.S. can get regular access to Cam Ranh Bay, that will readdress to some extent the Chinese advantage of the artificial islands in the South China Sea.
Right. So that would in turn, of course, be perceived as such by the People's Republic of China. We are out of time. We've been joined by Dr. Alexander Vuving. He's been talking in his own personal capacity, his own views, but he is a security analyst and professor at the Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Hawaii. We've been talking about President Obama's visit to Vietnam. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The Iraqi army has announced the beginning of an offensive to retake the city of Fallujah from the so-called Islamic State, Daesh or ISIS. Fallujah was the first city to fall to Daesh in 2014, but since then the territory held by the group has been sharply on the decline. We are joined by Iraqi-American political analyst Raed Gerard of the American Friends Service Committee. Welcome back, Raed.
Thanks for having me again.
What's going on? What, talk about the offensive. Has it begun?
News coming from Iraq indicate that there are no signs that the offensive has begun yet, but it seems like the Iraqi government has announced its intentions to start the offensive. U.S. sources have been denying that any operations have started taking place. So there is some confusion about that. At the same time, there are very shocking announcements by Iraqi militias describing Fallujah as a cancer that should be removed. And these announcements, of course, are concerning because these Iraqi militias have committed war crimes, in some cases crimes against humanity, when they attacked towns controlled by ISIS in the past. So there is the real concern that the anticipated attack on Fallujah will follow a pattern of abuses that were committed in the past by Iraqi forces and affiliated militias.
When the people of Ramadi returned to their homes after it was liberated, there was nothing left almost.
Correct. And there was a report by Human Rights Watch that came out last year. The report was entitled After Liberation Came Destruction. Of course, the word liberation is a very problematic word in this context, but I will comment on that in a second. Human Rights Watch's report shows a very premeditated systemic way that Iraqi forces and affiliated militias took towns back from ISIS and destroyed towns. They committed ethnic cleansing. They targeted some ethnicities against other ethnicities, demolished homes of some sects and kept homes of other sects. So it's a larger campaign of ethnic cleansing and using ISIS as an excuse to bombard these towns and go in them seems to be a pretext for implementing a premeditated strategy of ethnic cleansing and destruction that the Iraqi government has been following since 2003.
The United States government purportedly had a difference of opinion with the Iraqi government over where to attack, where to launch an offensive against Daesh or ISIS. The announcement from some media is that the United States really favored the retaking of Mosul as a top priority. Of course, Mosul is the third largest city in Iraq. It was captured by ISIS in a lightning offensive in June 2014, I believe. What accounts for the difference from your point of view?
From my point of view, that is not the discussion we should be having. It's not about which city to bombard first. It's not about which city to allow the United States allies and militias to attack first. It's about how to deal with issues of extremism and violence in Iraq and the region. And that's why I wanted to comment on the word liberate, because the word liberate, implies that there is a legitimate force that will come in to kick out an illegitimate group. And that is not the situation in Iraq. Iraq has many extremist and violent groups, including the government forces. And what's going on is some of these cities in Iraq are switching over between some you know, extremist and violent group called ISIS, and sometimes another extremist and violent group called the Iraqi forces and their militias. So it's not really an issue of liberation by legitimate forces that are seen by Iraqis as representing them. It is only an issue of handover between different sectarian militias that are destroying the country. So if the United States wants to give good advice to Iraq, I think we have to start by stopping our support to groups in the Iraqi government who have been committing mass violations of human rights. Funding these groups is actually illegal under U.S. laws and under international law. We continue to give weapons and support to groups that have committed atrocities in Iraq. And number two, we have to think about larger strategies to bring actual real peace to the country, and that will include ways to address the root causes of the conflict in Iraq. This includes, you know, sectarian politics that are adopted by the Iraqi government. This includes militias that are affiliated with the Iraqi government or other militias like ISIS who are not affiliated with the Iraqi government. But the idea of getting rid of all of these things will not include dropping more bombs on Iraq. Dropping more bombs will not make Iraq more peaceful. It will not make these groups more moderate. It will actually cause more death and destruction. And that is what the U.S. has been doing in the country since 1991. And starting a new offensive on Fallujah or on Mosul will not solve the country's crisis.
Talk about the people inside Fallujah, the civilian population. I mean, it's a very densely packed city. The reports are that ISIS is telling people they can't leave. The Iraqi government is telling them they must leave. There's no way out. There's probably no place to hide. I mean, what happens again to the civilians?
They're the ones who pay the heavy price. And many of them have been paying a heavy price, not as a consequence to violence, like a byproduct to violence, but because that is the actual goal of violence. The Iraqi militias, especially those affiliated with the Iraqi government, have been implementing a plan of displacement in Iraq. So whether it's ISIS or militias affiliated with the government, Shiite militias or Kurdish militias in the north, they have been trying to gain more territory by displacing civilians from their homes. So the point that I'm making is that the displacement of civilians is not happening as a byproduct to larger violence. It's actually the goal of violence. Iraqi militias are attacking towns because they want to displace people out of these towns. It's not like they're attacking towns with violence and then people are leaving because they're fearing for their lives. So because of that, you know, this is a different analysis than what you would hear on mainstream media in the U.S., where the violence is portrayed as a part of the medicine, it's a part of the solution. What we are told in the U.S. is that we have to attack Fallujah and Mosul because that is the way to get rid of the bad guys and you know, liberate these towns. That's not what's going on in real life. In real life, this is more violence that has illegitimate agendas to displace more Iraqis and create more sectarian and ethnic enclaves in the country. And unfortunately, this policy of dividing Iraq on sectarian and ethnic lines in the country continues to be the U.S. main policy in Iraq. And it is a policy that has destroyed the Iraqi national identity. It's a policy that continues to destroy Iraqis and kill them every day.
Senator, or then Senator Joseph Biden, actually called for the partition of Iraq at the time that the U.S. was unable to defeat the armed and civil opposition to the U.S. occupation that began March 19, 2003. That's not the formal position now of the Obama administration that Biden is the vice president of. What you're saying, Raed Gerard, is that the United States actually opts for de facto partition. And if that's the case, then what would be the function of the military operations either in Ramadi before or in Fallujah or in Mosul, where the United States is partnering with the Iraqi government and sometimes with commandos, sometimes with air support, sometimes with both, to carry out these military operations?
I mean, your question is a good question. I think it should be asked to the U.S. Why is the U.S. supporting these operations? I don't think that the Obama administration has a larger plan. There are small bits and pieces of plans about supporting partners to defeat terrorism, but I don't think there is a larger roadmap for stabilizing Iraq. Now, regarding the support of division of Iraq, if you ask the White House, do you support dividing Iraq, they will say, no, of course we don't. But if you ask them, would you support a federal system in Iraq that is based on sectarian and ethnic affiliations, they will say yes. And that is the difference. It's a difference of terminology. The Obama administration has been calling it federalism, but in Iraq, it's a de facto division. So it's a different type of federalism than the one that we know in the U.S. Imagine if the Obama administration proposes a new system of federalism in the U.S. where African Americans live in a region, you know, white Americans live in a region, Hispanic Americans live in a region, and then start moving tens of millions of people around in the country to create this new federalism. I don't think we would like federalism in the U.S. So, because in the U.S. we have more of a geographic federalism than a demographic federalism. The federalism that the U.S. is promoting and has been promoting in Iraq for the last decades is a demographic federalism that would divide Iraqis based on their ethnicities and sectarian backgrounds. And that's why these ethnic and sectarian cleansing campaigns have been going on.
The city of Ramadi, the town of Fallujah, the city of Fallujah, they're predominantly Sunni areas in Anbar province. Mosul is a mixed bag historically. It has a great sort of diversity to it. Do you see, and this is recognizing what you're saying, recognizing the foundational difference in terms of your position than the U.S. government position or the Iraqi government position or the one presented in the corporate mainstream media here, is it your position that if the United States were to, say, capture, along with the Iraqis, the town of Fallujah and Mosul, that the populations in those areas could not possibly be represented by the so-called liberators because their agenda really is to drive them out of their homes?
Correct. I mean, that is definitely an issue of representation. Iraqis who live in Fallujah and Ramadi do not see the Iraqi forces and sectarian militias that are attacking their homes and towns as a liberating force. And that is one of the reasons why many Iraqis who are not supportive of the agenda or programs of ISIS are not fighting against ISIS. Because from their perspective in Fallujah or in Ramadi, getting rid of ISIS might end up hurting them more, because the alternative to ISIS is an even more destructive militia that will come to their homes and destroy them even worse than ISIS. So imagine if you have your own government that is even worse than ISIS, and you feel that getting rid of ISIS might expose you to more dangers. Imagine what type of a choice Iraqis are left with. So yes, the answer to your question is that unfortunately, the majority of Iraqis do not see the Iraqi central government as representative to the people. And these also include Iraqi Shiites. You know, we saw the uprising in Baghdad in the last few weeks and how Iraqi Shiites have broken, mostly Iraqi Shiites have went into the green zone demonstrating against this government that they view as sectarian, as destructive, as a government that has destroyed the national unity of the country. So it's not really an issue of Shiites wanting to attack Sunnis. It's an issue of Shiite militias in the government, sectarian Shiite militias in the government, who are attacking Sunni territories now. At the same time that there are sectarian Sunni militias like ISIS who are attacking Shiites and Christians and others. And that's why it takes me back to my original point. This is not a situation where the U.S. and its allies are getting rid of the bad guys. This is a situation where there are many bad guys, including the United States' own allies, and we continue to support some bad guys against other bad guys.
We have 2 minutes left, Rayid Jarar. I want to ask you about the U.S. presence. President Obama came into office in 2009, January 2009, on the basis that he was going to end all U.S. involvement in Iraq. He did that by the end of 2011 when the Iraqi government refused to grant immunity to American soldiers. But now they're back, and President Obama is handing off Iraq to the next president. And he says now this is an endless war. They now have almost 5,000 U.S. troops, even though they say there's no boots on the ground. Is the U.S. ever going to leave Iraq?
It's a very frustrating question. I spent almost my entire life witnessing the U.S. intervention in Iraq. The U.S. military intervention in Iraq started in January of 1991. So 25 years ago, and under four different administrations, the United States continued more or less the same policies. And these policies include military intervention, and they include pushing Iraq for division. So in the 1990s, there were almost weekly bombings of Iraq, and there was a support for a so-called no-fly zone that was based on an assumption that there is a Kurdistan in the north, a Sunnistan in the middle, and a Shiastan in the south. And this assumption continues until today. The military intervention continues until today. So I'm very frustrated and disappointed that President Obama ran on a platform to end the war in Iraq, but he ended up doing nothing more than being the fourth U.S. president to continue the war on Iraq. U.S. policies have not shifted under the Obama administration. We went back to square one now. We are not only interfering in Iraq, we are also supporting proxy groups who are committing heinous crimes using U.S. tax dollars.
Raed Girard, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been talking about the battle in Fallujah that may be about to begin. We've been talking to Raed Girard. He's with the American Friends Service Committee. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. The second police officer charged in the death of Freddie Gray, Edward Nero, has been found not guilty of all four misdemeanor charges. Will justice ever be served in the death of Freddie Gray that triggered last year's rebellion in Baltimore, Maryland? We are joined in studio by author and activist Eugene Perrier. Welcome back, Eugene.
Thank you so much for having me.
Were you surprised by the verdict? Not a guilty. The last one was a hung jury. Talk about it.
Well, I can't say I was surprised, given that there is the hung jury in the first case. But I mean, I have to say I was a little bit dumbfounded in many ways. I mean, I think obviously what we have here is all six officers who were charged obviously engaged in what was a clear pattern of misconduct on so many different levels. And the crazy thing is a lot of them are admitting this, saying that, yes, they knew, for instance, that Freddie Gray being belted in the seat in the back of the police van was actually something that they were required to do. But then they're arguing, well, but no one ever really did that, so we shouldn't really be held responsible for it. And so, I mean, this is a situation where you even have police officers admitting to violating their own procedures, and somehow it seems as if, you know, there's still no conviction. I think it's 100% clear there's a double standard for police officers. I mean, if we go sit in any Baltimore City court, we'll see any number of young black males sent to prison on much less evidence than this.
Let's go back. Let's talk about Freddie Gray, the person. Freddie Gray was a young man. He was from Baltimore. He came into contact with police officers on April 12th, and that day he died. What happened?
So what took place is that what turned into the altercation is one officer made eye contact with Freddie Gray. And after the eye contact, Freddie Gray turned and went in the other direction, which caused the officer to chase after him, saying, oh, he must have been doing something wrong. But this is a city in Baltimore with one of the most unbelievable records of police brutality across the entire nation. And we saw this briefly during the Democratic primary campaign when Martin O'Malley was called on this several times, the record under the mayor where tens of millions of dollars were paid out over a small number of years in order to settle these claims of people who had been brutally abused by the police.
It was like $50 million or something.
Something of that nature. And so what you see is that obviously Freddie Gray had a probably had a reason to be as scared of the police of anything else. Yet they chose, after making eye contact and I guess him, you know, having a bad look in his eyes, that they were going to go down. The officers follow him on bikes. There was two officers that followed him on bikes. They arrested him, and in the course of the arrest, one of the witnesses who saw this said it looked like they were folding Freddie Gray. I mean, they had him down, they had him prone, they were handcuffing him, but they were putting him in extreme stress positions. And then once they had him handcuffed, one of the officers puts his knee into the back, into the spinal cord of Freddie Gray. Now, this is crucially important because obviously, as many people know, 75% of Gray's spinal cord was severed in the course of the rough ride. And I think it's 100% clear there was serious injury done to his back by this knee to the spine, which is something police officers are told not to do on a regular basis in terms of subduing a subject.
So Freddie's chased on by cops on a bicycle because he made eye contact with a police officer, and thus they started to go after him. He ran. He's scared. The police have a history of police brutality and violence, especially against young black people and young black men in the city of Baltimore. Not unique, of course, to the city of Baltimore, but very prevalent in Baltimore. They get him down. They're folding him up, according to the witnesses. One of the cops has his knee in the back. Now, Freddie Gray has a very bad spinal injury and perhaps a broken back or a broken neck by that time. They're dragging him. The video shows they're dragging him into a police van. What's a rough ride?
So a rough ride is where an individual who's been arrested by the police or taken into custody, I should say, is not, when they're placed in the police van, they are not belted in to the van. And the reason why they're not belted in is then through both normal driving and sort of deliberately aggressive driving, if you will, the person is thrown around in the back of the van. And it's essentially a way to kind of beat a suspect without beating a suspect. It's something that was obviously known and well known in Baltimore. This came out after the uprising. Many people saying this is par for the course for Baltimore police. We've already talked about how brutal they were. So that even though Gray is clearly injured there, clearly injured to some degree, they did not deliberately belt him in, knowing that that was the case. And it came out actually during the Nero trial that, in fact, it is well known that this regulation now, something they're supposed to do, is almost never followed, I believe, was what one of the individuals said. So ultimately, they put him in there. They didn't belt him in with the express purpose of trying to punish him for running away from the police.
And punished he was. Okay, so he's got perhaps a broken back, a serious injury of one type. He's not belted in. He's in the back of a van. In other words, a big metal sort of cage. And then they're driving around, and they take a while to get to the police station. And while they're on the way, they stop and take a look at how is Freddie Gray doing. Talk about that.
Yes. Yeah, so they took a look at him, and they took a look at him, I believe, two separate times. And one of the times, and this will come up much later in one of the later trials, he was completely non-responsive. And rather than call for any sort of medical care, anything like that, to someone who's completely non-responsive, been caroming around in the back of this van, clearly injured before they came in, the officer on the scene at that time actually just closed the door and said, keep going. So the whole time, it's very clear to them. Freddie Gray had already asked them previously for some form of medical assistance. And so throughout the whole rough ride, before the ride even begins, there's a clear desire to injure and to hurt Freddie Gray, and a clear unwillingness of the police to do anything to treat his medical symptoms, even when he was completely non-responsive on the floor of the van.
And then we know that when Freddie Gray happened, and this happened, Eugene, per year after the Michael Brown killing, after the Eric Garner killing, of course, the killings in the black community and the Latino community happened almost every day, literally, actually, every day. But it's been a movement now for the past couple of years because video has captured it. People rose up in Ferguson, Missouri. There is a spirit of resistance, and that resistance took to the streets in Baltimore. There were no indictments yet when the people of Baltimore, the young people, they rose up.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I had the opportunity to be up there in the days following the uprising for 3 or 4 days. And, you know, up there at Pennon North, I think it's so clear for so important for people to understand what happened, because the way it was proclaimed is if it was just hooligans running around on the street, torching everything they could find. There's only 3 buildings that have been burned. CVS. And if anyone who's ever been to a CVS in an oppressed black community in this country knows, they lock everything up, sometimes even up to the soap, and they treat every person who walks through the doors as some sort of criminal. 2 was the check cashing place, which is the most unbelievably usurious way of abusing people who aren't able to get bank accounts, don't have bank accounts, cashing their checks. True swindling. I mean, there's no other way to look at it. And 3 were liquor stores, where one liquor store, obviously, where there's many people. We know the problems with the mental health system in this country. Many people who are self-medicating. So, in fact, there was a lot of very logical actions that took place. People expressing their clear anger at the circumstances in which they are kept in, at the unbelievable loop of victimization that they're placed into, the oppression and exploitation that they face on a day in and day out basis, and the Freddie Gray incident, which was indicative of how so many of these people have been treated by the police for decades now, finally boiled over.
Yeah, those young people had their own firsthand experience. They didn't have to just read the newspaper or watch TV to find out about Freddie Gray. They had similar things happen to them, and that was routine in Baltimore, as we know. And as you mentioned, maybe $50 million in lawsuits by the police, routinely paid for by taxpayers' money for their acts of criminal brutality and violence against young people in Baltimore. But I want to talk again a little bit about the uprising that took place. The media, especially the corporate-owned media, sensationalizes. You mentioned that there were a couple buildings that were on fire. But it wasn't just looting. It wasn't just buildings on fire. There were thousands and perhaps tens of thousands of people in the streets chanting, marching, demanding. In other words, it really was a mass grassroots movement.
Oh, I think so. Absolutely. And it's one of those things that always gets lost. But the reality of the situation was this, is that there were multiple protests happening every single day of the week all across the city, and really organized in ways that are really, you know, from very organized to completely spontaneous demonstrations in communities. I mean, I said I was there for 3 or 4 days. I must have been in 12 or 15 demonstrations, and many of them were spontaneous, and some were almost celebratory in terms of communities coming together in ways that I think people hadn't seen in a long time. And that's, in a way, you know, the one thing people kept saying when I was in the streets of Baltimore is Baltimore's back, Baltimore's back. And people felt like they had gone from this sense of complete powerlessness, complete deprivation, complete marginalization of the system, to that they were finally being heard. People were so excited to be able to talk to the media from around the world to counter the misperceptions about them, and an unbelievable sense of community, really, for those 3 or 4 days after the uprising, just totally pervaded the community. Every person who came from other cities, we were just welcomed in unbelievable. I remember having a conversation with 2 gang members and an old church lady. I mean, really, the way people came together was fantastic. The way it was bleeding out into political movements was great. And I think we've seen going on here, both new and old organizations working for social justice have really been renewed by this.
Eugene Perrier, we know, too, that the rebellion ended when there were the announced indictments or prosecution of these 6 police officers. Marilyn Mosby, in the prosecutor's office, district attorney's office, she brought the charges. Now, that elicited a huge outcry by police, not just Baltimore police, but police unions around the country who were sort of demanding her head because she dared to bring about the indictment or prosecution of police officers. She said, when she made the announcement to the young people, especially, I think, she said, we are hearing you. We are listening to you. That's what she said when she announced the prosecution. But here we are a year later. The first cop who comes to trial, it's a hung jury, meaning the jury couldn't reach a unanimous verdict. The second trial with Nero, he's found not guilty. We have 4 more trials and 1 retrial to go. But talk about the way the prosecution has actually handled the case, because it seems that some of the police officers were given immunity. Some of the original police officers who did the worst in terms of the beatings of Freddie Gray that perhaps broke his back or neck, their charges were a little bit different. But it seems like they can't get a guilty verdict here.
No, it's very strange. And really quickly, between 2010 and 2014, the Baltimore police were paying out on average $3 million a year in police misconduct cases. So 4 years, average of $3 million a year. I mean, it appears as if the case is being completely bungled by Mosby. Now, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't tell, but what it appears to be happening in the order by which the people are being tried is that they're trying to prove that the arrest itself was unwarranted before they then go on to prove that Freddie Gray was clearly abused and mistreated. I don't know what the strategy is behind that, but it's completely falling apart because all of the officers appear to be just trying to pass the buck to other officers, not explicitly saying it was someone else's fault, but basically saying, well, hey, what you're saying happened, that wasn't my responsibility, that aspect of it. I wasn't supposed to be doing that, and thus I can't be held responsible. And in the hung jury and in the bench trial, that seems to be the case. And it really makes you wonder why in the Nero trial, Officer Miller was given immunity when both by the record and the appearance of the video, Miller is more central to the arrest of Gray and under immunity basically testified and said, yeah, it's all on me. You can't hold Nero responsible. He was a new, younger cop. He was a bystander. He didn't know how he did things, so on and so forth. And so basically they seem to have given immunity to the wrong person, to the person who was more guilty. And now it appears their whole trial strategy is completely in shambles because, you know, hearing the case, it appears that they could have tried some of the more egregious issues, but perhaps they were afraid of some other thing. So it seems that they rushed to judgment in how they put the case together to try to placate the community in Baltimore. I was there when Mosby announced it. She said, we've heard your cries of no justice, no peace. And it seems as if the Baltimore authorities, who were caught completely flat-footed now when the uprising kicked off, were looking for a way to try to corral the anger very quickly and put together a case that, while I think clearly there's culpability there, seems to be put together in almost sort of an ad hoc, slipshod manner. And it is quickly falling apart.
So the first officer, Garrett Miller, was the one granted immunity, but he perhaps was the greatest wrongdoer. So he's given immunity, meaning he can't be prosecuted. And he says, OK, yeah, I take more of the responsibility. And then the others who are brought to trial, they don't have the main guy. So, yeah, it looks like this prosecution is coming down undone. Eugene, per year, there's 2.3 million people in the United States prisons or jails, maybe a few more. The United States has 5% of the world's population, but 25% of the world's prisoners. You wrote a book about this, about mass incarceration in the United States. But the people who are not in prison are police officers, even though they kill routinely, carry out violence routinely. Why are the police generally in America exempt?
Well, I think ultimately, how could they do their job if they were not exempt? I mean, the reality is that we put these, not we, but the government, puts these police officers in communities to enforce laws that are essentially the criminalization of people's social existence. Either people working in the black or the gray market, which is technically illegal, and it's all about controlling space and controlling place, and also controlling all the fallout from all the other social consequences of a devastated mental health system, joblessness, poverty, unemployment. I mean, everything we could go down the list of. So it creates an us versus them mentality for the police, where they are there to be the people who hold the lid on a boiling pot to keep it from boiling over. And ultimately, since they are not, they have no solutions. They can offer no solutions. All they can do is act punitively. They are going to criminalize people. They are going to look for shortcuts to criminalize people, to arrest people, to make themselves look as if they're doing the job. And in those kind of gray area situations, obviously, many things are going to come up where people are going to end up being killed. But if you hold them responsible, how can you then tell a police officer to go out and do their job in these communities where it's an us versus them mentality? So I think ultimately, the reason the police face so much impunity is a built-in nature of their job, is their knowledge that if there is any sort of situation where they have to kill someone or brutalize someone, that they are going to be able to get off. If not, it would not be possible for them to operate like an occupying army. All occupying armies also are exempt from the type of behavior they treat people with in the occupied land. I think it's the exact same mentality.
So it's social control. It's not about crime. I mean, you have huge, vast parts of America. One out of every two Americans now is either in poverty or near poverty. Neoliberal globalization has devastated inner cities and formerly industrial states like Maryland, for instance, which used to have a thriving steel industry. So the police are there for social control and the violence is routine and they're routinely exempt or immunized from any prosecution. That's all the time we have. We want to thank Eugene Per Year. We'll be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.